This is a recording of the Kimberly Escobar teleconference with the National Environmental Trust, scheduled for 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, November 8, 2007. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Judith Robinson. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Judith Robinson. I'm with the Environmental Health Fund, and I'll be moderating this call. I'd like to welcome the reporters who've joined us, and thank you very much for coming on, and to urge you to visit our website, www.isitinus.com. Again, isitinus.com for additional information. This call is being recorded and will be available on the website for reference. This afternoon, we're discussing a report entitled Is It In Us? Toxic Trespass, Regulatory Failure, and Opportunities for Action. This documents the results of blood and urine testing of 35 people from 7 states for the presence of 3 classes of chemicals, phthalates, bisphenol A, and polybrominated diphenyl ethers, also known as PBDEs. The project found all 3 classes of toxic chemicals in every person tested. We're going to run through our speakers first, and then following this, we will have a Q&A. The speakers will be Cheryl Patton of Commonweal. She is the report coordinator. Elaine Nekritz, Illinois state legislator and project participant. Dr. Shauna Swan, professor of obstetrics and gynecology, University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. And Dr. Ted Shetler, science director, Science and Environmental Health Network. With that, I would like to introduce it back to Cheryl Patton of Commonweal.
Thanks a lot, Judy, and thanks, everybody, for joining this call. We really appreciate your interest in the story. Today, 35 people are stepping forward to talk about the presence of toxic chemicals found in their bodies. These 35 people come from 7 different states: Alaska, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois, New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. These people look like your neighbors. They include firefighters, moms, state legislators, leaders in the spiritual community, fishermen, people that live right next door to you, and actually could be you. As Judy said, they've been tested for 3 classes of chemicals. Phthalates, which is a chemical that is used to soften plastic, and you can find it in shower curtains, medical tubing. It's also used in personal care products as a scent stabilizer. A class of flame retardants called PBDEs, found in foam furniture and fabrics. Bisphenol A is a substance that's used to harden plastics, and you're going to find it in those clear plastic water bottles that everyone likes to use. You'll find it in tin cans. It's also used as a sealant on teeth to prevent cavities. You can also find it in CDs and DVDs. All our participants had levels of these chemicals in their bodies. We don't know always the pathway of exposure, but we do know these chemicals enter people's body by the food they eat, the water they drink, and also the products they use. The sad truth is these chemicals are known to be toxic from animal studies, and yet they're found in everyday products. This doesn't make sense to us at all, that this should be legal and that we should find our chemicals in our body, that people who've spent their lives picking the bugs off roses by hand and eating organic food, doing their bicycle ride every morning, suddenly find that their bodies actually do contain these toxic chemicals. It's not a good idea. We know some of the health outcomes of these chemicals. They've been related in animal studies and some human studies to cancer, neurological problems, diabetes, asthma, obesity, and infertility, among many others. There's many other chemicals out there that we know in products that haven't been tested. Are they harming animals? And could they harm animals in lab studies? We don't know that. How do they interact? How could they harm us? This is not a good idea. We hope that this report will raise awareness among the general public and legislators and companies for the following actions on following things. First of all, we think toxic chemicals, they really need to be phased out. we need to find safer alternatives for these chemicals. Safer alternatives means safer substances, safer processes. We think it would be a really good idea if chemicals were all screened for their toxicological effects before they're put on the market, put in products, and end up in our bodies. We think that green technology should be promoted. We should be working to develop safer alternatives that are accessible and useful to all of us. And lastly, we really think that people that live in communities where these toxic chemicals are produced, used, stored, or disposed of need to be protected from exposures to these toxic chemicals. This all makes sense to us. And really, if you were a parent, if you knew a chemical that was known to cause cell problems in lab animals, making them more likely to contract breast cancer later on in life, or cancer of the male genitalia, likely to cause obesity and diabetes, likely to cause miscarriage in lab animals and exposure, if you knew this chemical is also in your child's baby bottle, you wouldn't be buying that baby bottle. It's just not fair to you and to our children to know these chemicals are in everyday products. Okay, Judy, that's all I have to say for now, and I'd like to turn it back to you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Next, I'd like to introduce Elaine Nekras. She's an Illinois state senator and also a project participant.
And I'd love to be a senator, but I'm a House member, so I'm a representative. But
oh, did I say I meant
to say
legislator?
I've spent the last 3 years working on some chemicals, toxic and toxic chemicals policy in Illinois. So when Environment Illinois came to me and asked if I would participate in this project, it was really a pretty easy decision for me to make. I was already pretty convinced that if I did this testing, I would find that these chemicals were in my body. The only real question was to what extent. It was still disturbing, however, when I saw it in black and white and saw that some of my levels were higher than average and others were lower, and I still don't know why, and I don't know that I'll ever know why that was my result. And it was also distressing to learn that every participant had these chemicals in them, regardless of their age and their lifestyle, the choices they make when buying products. But I'm really confident that rather unfortunate reality can also be the impetus to not only the participants in the project, but also the public at large, to start demanding change in our chemicals policy. I am hopeful that in the long run there will be some changes in our federal policy, but in the interim, I know that the states are really moving ahead quickly on with legislation to put into place bans on not only the products that were part of this project, but also other chemicals, putting in place registration requirements and other limits on products, especially products used by children. So It was one of the most interesting things in Illinois and talking to the other participants was that many of them were really unaware that these were out there and thought that they were making healthy choices in the products they buy, and yet their levels were still like everybody else's. So there's just no way to avoid it. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Next, Dr. Shauna Swan, Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Dr. Swan?
Thank you, Judy, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk briefly about these chemicals. I think this testing is very important. I think the finding that 35 adult Americans show exposure to each of these classes of chemicals is not surprising, but I think it is alarming nonetheless. And I think to the people who were tested, and I've talked to some of them, it's very alarming, and I think putting a face to these exposures is very important. So I appreciate this project very much. You know, without having such testing, and it is very costly, and perhaps somebody could mention the cost per individual of the study, there's no way to know our own exposures. Epidemiologists used to ask people, did you smoke, did you do this and this and this, and you'd get their exposure that way. But you can't do that for these chemicals, and the reason is that they are silent, they're hidden, and they're pervasive. And so there's no way that anyone can know they're exposed without this very arduous and expensive procedure. The CDC has far greater resources, and they test for many more chemicals, and I think it's important to know that that number goes up every year. In the first CDC testing, they tested 27 chemicals. In the one that came out in the third report, 148, and the most recent, far more. And how are they named? How are they chosen? They're chosen on the basis of suspicion or evidence of toxicity and prevalence. That means that there are at least 148 chemicals out there in the majority or preponderance of Americans for most of them, and with evidence of harm, either in animal or human studies. And that number is growing. There are 80,000 chemicals in commerce, 1,000 added each year, and obviously we can't be testing for all of those. So the next thing I'd like to mention is that the CDC study, and this study did not look at infants, but we did. We looked at levels of phthalates in infants, and even the two-month-old infants had levels, and actually higher levels than adults. So these chemicals are present at birth. They're present actually before birth, because you can measure them in amniotic fluid and in cord blood. So no one is safe, and this is particularly important because the risk is actually the younger, you can think about it this way, the younger you are, the greater your risk. So the fetus is the most, is at greatest risk, and then the newborn, and then the young child, then the prepubertal adolescent, and then the adult. And the changes to the prepubertal, to the prenatal infant, the infant in utero, is are permanent and lifetime. So I think we have to put these all together, and we come up with a new paradigm for evaluating health risk from these kinds of chemicals. This new paradigm is not incorporated in current testing for chemicals. It's something that scientists have developed recently, and it has not made it into the testing schemes. And just let me characterize the new paradigm. The first thing is that exposures at very low environmental levels can cause significant effects, and these are often health effects. But they're often health effects to a population rather than an individual. So lead, for example, a small increase in lead will significantly change the IQ of the population. For an individual, that might not matter that much to lose 10 IQ points. To the population, it matters a great deal. I've mentioned the fact that the younger the age at first exposure, the greater the risk. And also that prenatal and perinatal changes lead to are permanent as opposed to adult exposures, which are transient. The changes that are manifest do so throughout the lifespan, so you can be exposed in utero and have changes which don't show up until adolescence or maturity or old age. And finally, the exposure to multiple chemicals at levels that are low and apparently safe together can result in significant adverse health effects. We all know that when we go to the doctor asks, what are we taking? What medications are we taking before we get a prescription? And that's because adding another medication to that mix, to that cocktail, might be very dangerous. And the same is true for chemicals in our bodies. There are, as I mentioned, 80,000 chemicals in commerce. The default assumption is that these chemicals are safe until proven to cause harm. This does not have to be the way legislation deals with this, and the new EU legislation, REACH, actually reverses this burden of proof. That's all I have to say right now.
Thank you, Dr. Swan. And you were referring just then to the European Union new regulations on chemicals management that appear to be leading the globe. Thank you very much. It's a chilling presentation, but there's certainly opportunities for action. And as a parent of a child with a learning disability, I can tell you that 10 IQ points on an individual can make the difference between someone can work outside the home and live an independent life or not. Mm-hmm. So we're all individuals for sure. Thank you so much. Dr. Ted Shetler, Science Director, Science and Environmental Health Network. Would you please take the floor, Dr. Shetler?
Yeah, thanks, Judy. Good morning or afternoon. So this project shows us the chemicals that are put into everyday consumer products simply don't stay there. They end up in our food, water, air, house dust, on our skin, and then they end up circulating in our blood and breast milk and crossing the placenta and circulating in the fetal blood and the amniotic fluid in the womb. And I think it's important to emphasize that their presence is not normal. it's common, but it's not normal. The chemicals looked for and detected in this project are linked primarily through animal testing, and in some cases through human testing, to birth defects, asthma, cancer, learning disabilities, obesity, and diabetes. These are all conditions of urgent public health concern. Let me make 2 points. First, we actually do have some information about the potential health impacts of the chemicals identified in this project. Each of these chemicals was on the market for years before safety data that we now have and continue to collect on an almost weekly basis became available. And what we now know about these chemicals raises real public health concerns, particularly since exposures are so ubiquitous. But for the majority of widely used industrial chemicals to which people are regularly exposed, we have very limited data. And in some cases, we have nothing more than rudimentary screening information, and frequently not even that. There is virtually no requirement for comprehensive safety testing of most industrial chemicals before they are marketed in products. Secondly, even when we do have some safety information, with few exceptions, it almost always addresses exposure to single chemicals in isolation. But as we can see here, ordinary people are not exposed to single chemicals in isolation. Each of us is exposed to multiple chemicals in varying proportions and combinations, in men, women, children, fetuses, of various ages, genetic makeup, nutritional status, and social circumstances, many with underlying health conditions that can sharply influence responses to environmental agents. So even when they're tested at all, most chemicals are not tested in the combinations that we actually experience them. And in medicine, as Shauna just mentioned, we're well aware of what is often called polypharmacy that can lead to unpredictable impacts and outcomes. Projects like this one and others show that ordinary people are regularly exposed to multiple industrial chemicals. For most of them, we do not have good safety data. So it's abundantly clear, I think, that in the U.S. we are in urgent need of chemical policy regulatory reform that will require pre-market development of safety data sufficiently comprehensive to protect public environmental health, and that will create the incentives and the requirements to move to safer alternatives when problematic chemicals are identified. So I'll stop there, Judy.
Thank you, Dr. Shetler. We're trying to put the genie back in the bottle because it's already in us. I want to move now to the question and answer portion where you'll be able to, we'll open your lines and you'll be able to ask our speakers questions. I also want to introduce two people that we're going to add to the question pool. The first is Dr. Wade Welshens, and he's of the Department of Biomedical Sciences at the University of Missouri-Columbia, and he is also an expert on bisphenol A, and we're happy to have him on the phone. In addition, Andy Agrajis of the National Environmental Trust, he'll also be on the line and is talking, can answer questions about policy considerations along with some of our other speakers. Now I'd like to turn it over to the operator to provide instructions.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, the floor has been open for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. And if at any point you need to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Our first question comes from Miriam Falco with CNN.
Hi, I've got a couple of questions. So you found these chemicals in all 35 people. Can you tell me what levels are too much for humans? And given the fact that you're suggesting that these chemicals need to be phased out, one of two things can happen. Either you remove every product that has these chemicals right now, which is probably very unrealistic, or it's going to be quite some time before replacement products exist to swap them out. So, number one, I'm trying to figure out what is the level that's too high for people to have these chemicals in them, and then what is it that you're asking for?
Does someone want to speak to the first point?
This is Shauna, and I can just say that for phthalates,
In our study, we found that the levels at which 25% of the U.S. population are exposed, based on the NHANES data, the CDC data, 25%, that point at which 25% or more, you know, were exposed to that level or higher, were associated with significant changes in the genitals of their male children. I would say that's probably too high. I don't know, we don't have such detailed and specific information for the other chemicals at this point, but I think that I was guided in my study by by rodent studies, and I think that, we have to turn to that now because we can't wait for the human data. So the other question about alternatives.
Wait a second. In the rodent studies, what kind of exposure are they put under versus what humans are? I mean, that's the problem with rodent studies, that you can't automatically assume what works in a or causes cancer in a rodent is going to cause cancer in a human being.
That's absolutely correct. And the exposure levels in the rodent studies were considerably higher than those that we measured. We don't know what people are exposed to. We only know what's in their body. So we don't know the dose, the equivalent dose. So that translation is very difficult to make.
Okay,
but,
so then how, what are you trying, what is the take-home message here then? So everybody had the levels. How many of the 35 people had cancer or birth defects or whatever? I mean, what is the result of them having the cancer? I don't know what the take-home message here is. That
we have
chemicals in them, that I think is known.
This is Ted Shetler. This is an exposure study. It is not a health impact study. Let's be real clear about this.
Okay.
This was exposure only. There was no attempt made to make draw any correlation between the levels of chemicals in these 35 people and their health status. There was none. That kind of work can be done with biomonitoring studies, and it's certainly something is being done with a lot of the CDC data, where you have a much larger population and you can begin to look for the correlations between levels and health outcomes. What Shauna was just describing was an independent study that she had done at her university, where she had a totally separate epidemiologic study, and she was describing the results of that. With respect to these other chemicals, I would just add that the answer, of course, about a so-called safe level varies from one chemical to another. So there have been studies done in the United States more generally looking at levels of the various PBDEs, the flame retardants, and one of the conclusions that's been drawn is that the more highly exposed people in the upper 10% or so of the U.S. population, if you look at the PBDEs collectively, are very close to the levels that actually do cause neurodevelopmental impacts in rodent studies. That's the best we have right now. We have zero information on the neurodevelopmental impacts of flame retardants in people, but we have substantial and coherent rodent data. Wade Welshans can speak to the bisphenol A issue and what these levels mean.
Wade?
Yes. Well, for bisphenol A, the levels in circulation after doses which create effects in animals, those levels in circulation are well below the levels measured in people where the levels were positive. And the median level in studies in Japan or in Asia and in Germany, those median levels are, while they're variable, they're around 2 nanograms per ml. The levels in animals which are bringing about effects are well below 1 nanogram per ml. So the human levels actually exceed the levels that bring about effects in animals by 10 to 100 to 1,000 fold. So for bisphenol A, we already know there's less than 1,000 fold. Well, there is a substantial superabundance of BPA compared to the circulating levels which bring about effects in animals. As to what the human effects are, again, those kinds of epidemiological studies haven't been done, and this study, of course, doesn't look at effects with exposure or circulating levels. But on the other hand, to my knowledge, this is the first measurement of bisphenol A in the blood of Americans. Prior studies, as I said, were in Europe and Asia. And the levels in humans here in these studies are actually right in the middle of these other ones, which was which is a little arresting because at any rate, these are the levels measured everywhere.
And what were the levels that were measured?
Roughly a third of the people measured here had BPA in blood at and above the level that we consider a secure measure, so less than about 0.5 or 0.3 nanograms per ml. Many of the people, perhaps a fifth, had BPA at and above a nanogram per ml.
So how many
this
had
is Representative
it?
Nekrasen.
Excuse me?
Because you were saying that the median in Europe was 2 nanograms per ml.
Right.
So you didn't find that in any of these 35, and I realize it's a very small study.
Oh, no. We found levels as high as 6.
Okay.
So, yes, the human and the studies in Germany have focused on pregnant women and the fetus, fetal cord blood, and there's evidence that the levels in pregnant women are actually higher. The individuals in these studies were not pregnant women. So this isn't a direct comparison to those values. But the mean values, for example, of BPA in non-pregnant women in several studies, or men and women, are right within this range.
Hey, thank you. Our next question comes from Julie Tierdorf with the Chicago Tribune. Ma'am, please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Elaine, what were your PBDE levels and what's going on with your legislation here in Illinois? And I have a follow-up, too.
Okay. I had some that were above the CDC level and some that were below the CDC mean. So,
like what percentile in the CDC, like were you in the top 50% in the CDC level?
No, you know what, Julie, I can get that to you.
Okay, if you want
I'm happy
email
to share.
To
I can't. I'll have to fax it to you because I can't. I only have it on a piece
of
paper.
Okay, but what's going on with any legislation here in Illinois with PBDEs and also now that Target's phasing out PVC, is there any movement with the phthalates?
We, I think, are going to be moving forward next year with a ban on the DECA BDE, similar to what we did last year. And I think rather than trying to go after these chemicals one at a time, when there's thousands of them out there, we're going to try to look at a more comprehensive approach to try to reduce the reduce all of them rather than try to go pick them off. So, no, I don't think we have any plans right now to do phthalates.
Okay. Can I ask one more? Overall question, did any of you, what's the point in telling people the results when they can't do anything, really? I mean, you can't avoid these chemicals. We don't know what the levels really mean yet. Is it simply to raise awareness about the problem, or is there another reason to let participants know their results?
This is Ted Shetler. I would just make this comment that, first of all, most people wanted to know the results. There was no obligation, obviously, to learn your results, but most participants did want to know the results. But secondly, I think it's that there are actually some things that people can do. In some cases where there are unusually high levels, you can begin a bit of an exploration of personal habits. Workplaces, homes, thinking it through to see where, if you can figure out where an exposure pathway might be, and reduce that. This doesn't always work, obviously, because as people have pointed out, these chemicals are ubiquitous in our lives. But in the cases of particularly high levels, sometimes you can't actually identify a source and do something about it.
Yeah, and actually related to the question that was posed earlier about alternatives, we don't have to turn the marketplace upside down looking for products that are safer than the ones that contain these chemicals. They're already on the shelves. So you can buy, as you just noted, Target is phasing out PVC because they have a problem with PVC containing lead, and as we've seen in many of the toy recalls, containing phthalates, and the toy recalls would suggest also many products containing lead that are also PVC. So the same can be true for bisphenol A in baby bottles. There are alternatives to that on the shelves right now. And PBDEs, we can certainly begin to find the products that have those chemicals in them and push the market to move away. It worked with lead. People found out what was in them as their lead levels. They found out the problems that were associated with exposure to lead, and then the laws changed. And that's what needs to happen here, too.
And let me just say that the people that step forward to be tested are people that are known to have a really strong commitment to the well-being of their families and their communities and the whole country, really. So they really wanted to step forward to bear witness to this toxic trespass in their bodies. So they know that there's some things they can do to lower their levels in cases of high exposure, but they also know they're working for future generations, that if they can become politically active and work for legislative initiatives or working market campaigns, they can do things that will make sure that babies are not born pre-polluted, and that could be important.
This is Wade Welsh. In terms of BPA exposure, one of the most important things is to know whether or not what one is doing has led to an exposure. There are many things you can do to reduce it if it rises to that priority, if it's detectable. One is, even if you want to use polycarbonate, is to not use it when it gets old or cloudy. The extraction of BPA increases tremendously. The other, as Charles mentioned, is to avoid it in baby bottles. They're glass or non-BPA releasing alternatives. It's very important, though, to know whether you have a level that merits some action, because there's always some action you can take to reduce exposure to BPA without turning one's marketplace upside down.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for your questions, ma'am. Our next question comes from Matt Shipman with Risk Policy Report. Sir, please go ahead.
I've just got one very quick question. I'm familiar with all of these contaminants. I write for a somewhat more technical publication, I guess. So putting this information out there, it's clear as to what change you would like to affect. Do you have anything more concrete than the release of this report in order to move in that direction? Is there legislative push planned, legal action, any sort of actual next steps that can be taken in order to move in the direction that you're talking about here?
This is Elaine Necklace. I can just tell you that, you know, looking at what Washington State and Maine have been able to do with the PBDEs and their efforts were in large measure based on reports similar to these. So I would think in the seven states that where this occurred, that will help the efforts in those states significantly. I don't know about at the federal level.
I think in each of the seven states that were people were tested, there are different legislative initiatives. But Andy Agresius, do you want to speak to the federal bill that's...
I would point out just late, actually, right when the call was getting started, Congressman Al Wynn issued a statement reacting to this report and saying that it's further evidence that they need to look at TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act. So I just direct you to that, and we can put that up on our website as well. You might want to contact his office. He chairs the committee that has the Subcommittee of Commerce.
I'm familiar with Albert Wynn's office.
I'm sorry?
I'm familiar with Albert Wynn's office.
Yeah, just for other people, he chairs the relevant subcommittee in the House. And in the last Congress, there was a proposed overhaul of the law, the Toxic Substances Control Act, called the KidSafe Chemicals Act by Senator Lautenberg and Congressman Waxman, and they tell us that they do plan to reintroduce that. They're refining it and plan to reintroduce it. And I know they got into that fight partly because they were looking at the lobbying the Bush administration was doing to tell the Europeans not to do REACH. And then as the Europeans went forward with their own chemical regulation anyway, they decided to look at our own law and propose an overhaul of it along these lines of reversing the burden of proof, getting more health effects data out there. So I think that we'll see TSCA reform increasingly. That's named the Law of Toxic Substance Control Act. I think we'll see that on the agenda of Congress in the future.
And I just want to say that I think we're really seeing a whole new day, too, because these are not isolated initiatives, but rather public health, children's health advocates, environmental health advocates are joining together, and they're focusing on an integrated campaign to change the way that chemicals are managed in our society so they're not in our bodies and the bodies of fetuses. So in addition to these state-level initiatives, and Andy just mentioned the Federal Kid Safe Chemicals Act, there are also market campaigns. So there's a campaign called the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, which is looking at the chemicals that are in deodorants, skin creams, aftershave, shampoo, conditioner, you know, et cetera, et cetera, in your health and beauty aisle and in your medicine cabinet, looking to ensure that the cosmetics companies are phasing out of these dangerous chemicals. Likewise, there's a PVC action consumer campaign that is targeting PVC products as they're manufactured, used, and disposed of. And there have been some significant successes there with Target and Walgreens and Walmart and other major retailers. There's a Healthy Building Network has a campaign that's focused on chemicals in the building sector, which is a major user of toxic chemicals, and of course we build our lives in them, and many, many more. Those are on the website, but there are a variety of market campaigns that are synergized with the policy work and all pushing to address this, the pre-pollution of babies and chemical contamination in all of us.
Okay, thank you for your question, Mr. Shipman. Our next question comes from Lori Townsend with Alaska Public Radio. Ma'am, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I heard a segment on NPR about 45 minutes ago discussing this study, and the report ended leaving listeners with a gentleman who wrote a book entitled Risk, I think it was, saying that there wasn't enough known, this is a very small study, and sort of discounted the efforts here. How will you meet that particular criticism about the fact that it was a small study across only 7 states?
This is Ted Shetler. I think that there's been no attempt to characterize this as a study that can be generalized in any way. If that's the kind of data that people are interested in, population-wide data, of course, the Centers for Disease Control has the best database. There have been other regional efforts depending on the chemical, but this was never meant from the outset to be generalizable to a population either regionally or nationally. Rather, it was an attempt and is an attempt to put a face and a story to the often sort of faceless data that are turned out through other sorts of biomonitoring efforts. So people like the legislator who's on the call now and many others who participated are able to take a look at their own chemical profile for these 3 classes of chemicals, compare them to national data, and to think about what it means for them. So it's one of the uses of biomonitoring is not to do something that's generalizable, but to tell a different kind of story, and that is what's to be done here. In terms of what the gentleman on the NPR show said, the fact that not enough is known shouldn't be a cause for complacency. Rather, it seems to me that when we're identifying the ubiquity of chemical exposures, the fact that not enough is known is actually rather chilling and is an urgent wake-up call to public health people to think about what that actually means, that we're conducting this absolutely uncontrolled experiment on an entire population of people when not enough is known. And where we do know things, as I pointed out in my remarks, we have real reasons for concern because of the links between these chemicals in animal testing primarily, and secondarily in some very early preliminary human data, and these various health conditions that are obviously a public health concern, including birth defects, cancer, asthma, obesity, diabetes, and so forth. So I think that this actually should be a wake-up call rather than a reason for complacency.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cheryl Hoag with Chemical and Engineering News. Ma'am, please go ahead.
Hi. There are companies that make these chemicals, and they're making money off of them. And they're pretty politically powerful. They like the existing system. They're comfortable with TSCA. Even though we know it's virtually impossible for EPA to control or even ban chemicals once they're on the market under TSCA, I'm interested in how you see politically this fight working out, and also whether the market campaigns, I think it was Shauna that mentioned Target and Walmart, that seems to be a much more effective way of addressing some of the concerns that you're raising.
That's why we're doing it all. This is Judith Robinson. That's why we're doing the market work and also the regulatory work, because as you say, the marketplace can change tomorrow, and providing consumers with the information that they have never had before. You've never seen these ingredients on a baby bottle before. Providing them with that, they get active. And they get active with their political representatives and at the store. And so this is going to push forward, we think, and through our work with progressive businesses and also with legislators who are concerned with this issue, we really think that the groundswell is going to move. The media is going to have to not relax into the corporate position that they've heard repeated over and over, but to do some real investigation of this, what's going on, why don't we know enough, why are babies pre-polluted. So the media is going to have a big role to play. But we're up for the fight.
And it's always good to remind the companies and the chemical manufacturers that in their families, there's always a child with some kind of learning disability. There's always a person with cancer, that they themselves are dealing with perhaps some of the results of toxic chemical exposures in this country. And wouldn't they like to eliminate that possible linkage if possible? Because the human suffering is enormous. Human beings are not data points, and they know that. So I think that message is coming home to them as well.
This is Elaine Neckritz. In fact, one of the participants in Illinois, someone who tried to be very conscious of the products she bought and so forth, and she had no idea about these kinds of chemicals, and she has now started organizing in her area and has an organization that she's got 40 members from all around the state, and that's something that can be very useful to policymakers fostering that kind of discussion.
Thank you for your question, Ms. Hope. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Again, that's star one on your touchtone phone if you have a question. Our next question comes from Pat Rizzuto with ENA. Please go ahead.
Actually, it's with the Bureau of National Affairs, but my question is, I'm sure I'm going to hang up the phone, and the next person I speak to will point out that CDC always states that the presence of a chemical in the body does not mean it's harmful, and that the cup of coffee I had this morning had many natural chemicals that are carcinogens. That doesn't mean I'm going to get cancer from drinking the cup of coffee. What would your response be?
This is Wade Welsh. For bisphenol A, we can say that these levels are above what produces these problems in animals. And part of the function or the approach of risk assessment is to keep the human exposures well below the levels which produce effects in rodents.
If you could describe the types of effects that you're talking about and also how that conclusion squares with the National Toxicology Program panel that recently reached the conclusion that there was only a few groups where they had some concern.
I was on the NIEHS panel that met in November of last year, And that was an expert panel that included people who actually worked with BPA. And the conclusion of that panel were completely opposite to those of the NTP panel. And there are a number of aspects of that that are under review. Those documents from the NTP panel haven't been finalized or released yet. While those of the NIEHS panel were published last month. Let's see, what was your question initially? Oh, the kinds of effects. BPA in animals produce a range of developmental exposures, that is, exposures to the fetus, produce effects in adults, which actually include a very large number of current epidemiological concerns. And some of the most recent ones are obesity in the obesity in animals that are developmentally exposed, earlier puberty, precancerous changes in prostate epithelium and mammary epithelium, behavioral changes that are considered equivalent to hyperactivity, reduced sperm count, a very large number of effects, which in fact have direct human correlates and which are epidemiological concerns at present. Those aren't epidemiological studies that connect them, but the associations there and the large numbers of them are very disturbing.
And when the CDC looks at these chemicals, they're looking at these chemicals one at a time. They aren't looking at how these chemicals might interact with each other or the fact that we're all exposed to hundreds of chemicals. EPA itself has estimated that we're all carrying about 600 chemicals. That's quite a lot. And as one of the humans out here that's carrying the number of chemicals in my body, I don't want them. I don't want them in my body, and I don't want to be carrying them around waiting for other studies to figure out whether or not how they might interact might be toxic to me. I would just soon get them out and have those studies done beforehand before they ever show up in my body. So that would be my response to that, the CD statement, that we really don't know how all these chemicals are going to interact with each other inside our bodies. We don't know how the timing of exposure might be affecting our health, and we don't know how all these other factors that affect health, such as genetic makeup, social conditions, nutrition, stress, things like this, can interact and possibly potentiate the effects of chemicals. And those are all the kinds of things that the CDC is not looking at when they're saying the simple presence of a chemical does not necessarily link to a health outcome.
I think we would also agree that the simple presence does not always imply a health outcome. Absolutely. But the absence of evidence should not be a reason to be complacent here, because in most cases, as several has pointed out, any human data that exist at all are really quite early, and many chemicals to which people are regularly exposed simply have not been examined for their health effects. The flame retardants are a wonderful example for me. They behave in animal studies in terms of their impacts on neurological development in ways that are very similar to polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, and do share some mechanisms that are probably relevant as well, disrupting thyroid hormone function and so forth. And we have fairly consistent animal data that addresses that. We have nothing in humans. Now, for PCBs, there have been a whole series of longitudinal studies that have gone on over decades now that have begun to really show the coherence of the data, whereby prenatal exposures to PCBs do have persistent impacts on neurological function, depending on what endpoints you're measuring. But it seems pretty clear, and these studies have been done in several places around the world. Those studies haven't even started, to my knowledge, with respect to the flame retardants. But the question I always have is, to the extent that we see the data in the flame retardants that looks like what the PCBs look like in animals, when do we know enough to act? And how many damaged brains in children are we going to require before we have the political will to make policy decisions? That's a political question. It's not a science question, but I don't think we should feel particularly comfortable because we lack data, because we're blindfolded with respect to the impacts of these chemicals in children's brains, when we have these animal data, we're sort of obligated to ask ourselves the question, when do we know enough to act?
Thank you.
Thank you for your question, ma'am.
Let me also just say that the KidSafe legislation, as Andy quickly put it, would reverse the burden of proof. And what he meant by that is that we would no longer, the government, the public, be required to prove that chemicals are guilty of causing harm before they go on, after they go on the shelf. The industry would be required to prove that they're safe before they get on the shelves. And that seems like a very common sense thing that, in fact, I think probably the majority of the population thinks is already happening, and it's not. Burden's on us to prove that it's unsafe, and that's a very big bar to deliver the damaged brains, as Ted puts it.
Ms. Robinson, there are no questions in the queue. Do you have any closing remarks?
Thank you so much for everyone who joined. In particular, the time and the expertise of our panel is greatly appreciated. And I do want to, in particular, thank Charles Patton, Dr. Shauna Swan, Representative Nekritz, Dr. Shetler, Dr. Welshuns, and Andy Egregious. Thank you so much for everyone. Please go to the website, www.isitinus.com. We'll be updating that with new information and links as the days go on.
And let me add just, Judy, that all of us on the call are available for further questions throughout the day and throughout the week.
Great.
Yeah.
Many thanks.
Okay, thank you. If our speakers could please remain on the line. This does conclude today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.